Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long,
no,
because truth crushed to earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Yes, because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long.
How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes,
that scaffold sways the future.
Yes,
behind
sir.
The dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes,
how long?
Not
long.
Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes,
he's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes,
his truth is marching on.
Yes,
he has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat.
Peace,
he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Yeah.
Glory, hallelujah. Glory, hallelujah.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization. And they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us, so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors, because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization, and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libations into the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diaspora, both objects of a global miasma that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation. I shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation. Those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation. I shame. Pour libation too to our children and those yet to be born. For they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity. For they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
Listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continuing the fight. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kraft. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank. And they are operating on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to the search portal, put in the Sankofa Historical Society, and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening. 6 o'clock, Warriors Way Radio, continuing the fight.
Hotel family, this is your brother, Kwasi Kraft. Kawatu, your warrior for the people. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the racial imbalance of Milwaukee's 2022 residential property assessment. Very fortunate to meet a young brother, a warrior, Reggie Jackson. He's a lead trainer for Nurturing Development Partners. I'll let him share that information with you in more detail. But before we get going, we're going to do an ancestral profile. Just over 30 years, if you can remember the name, Latasha Harlins. That was the 15-year-old that was. And before we go on, I'm going to ask for some of you, I'm hearing some noise in the background, if you can maybe mute your phones until you call in. Maybe that's why we're getting some interference there. But so again, we're going to be talking about Latasha Harlins. Now, Latasha Harlins, she was born January 1st, 1976, and she come to, I'll say murdered, March 16th, 1991. Now, she was an African-American girl who was fatally shot at the age of 15 by Shuja Dunku. Now, and the shooter, this Korean female, she was 51 years old, and she was a convenience store operator. Now, Du was tried and convicted of Harlan's voluntary manslaughter and Harlan's death based in a part of a security camera footage. Now, the judge sentenced Du to 10 years in state prison, but the sentence was suspended, and the defendant was instead of placed on 5 years probation with 400 hours of community service and a $500 restitution and funeral expenses. So that's what it came down to. The judge, this judge felt that this person, this dude, the 51-year-old that shot Latasha Harlins, was not a threat to society and felt that it was a tragic incident. She made a mistake, and she can tell what type of person needs to be in prison or would be a risk to society. And she felt that person, this Korean Soon-Ja Do store owner, was no longer a threat. And so she gave her that $400 hours of community service, $500 in restitution, and then she paid for the funeral expenses. The sentencing was widely regarded as an extremely light sentence, a frailed appeal, and it contributed to the 1992 Los Angeles riots because this was the targeting of Koreatown in Los Angeles. Now, Harlan's death came 13 days after the videotape beating of Rodney King. And so that's why it came, her death kind of got a little lost in regards to what took place. But this Latasha Harlins, she was from East St. Louis, and to Crystal Harlins was the mother, and a Sylvester Eichhoff Sr. And Latasha had one younger brother, Vester Eichhoff Jr., and one younger sister, Christina. The family moved from Illinois to South Central in Los Angeles in 1981. And in 1982, when Latasha was 6 years old, her father took a job in a steel foundry and while the mother worked as a waitress at a local tavern. And they lived near 89th and Broadway and a few blocks from Latasha, where she would be killed years later. Now, Eichhoff Sr. was known to be abusive towards Crystal, attacking and beating her from in front of Latasha and her younger siblings. Now, their unstable marriage eventually ended in 1983. And on November 27th, 1985, Krista was brutally shot dead outside of a Los Angeles nightclub. And Krista, that was Latasha's mother. Now, Cora Mae Anderson, Eichhoff's new girlfriend, was leaving Latasha, and the girlfriend leaving Latasha and her younger siblings care to the maternal grandmother, Ruth Harlan. And so the death of her mother had devastating impact on Latasha, who began to rebel, argue with maternal grandmother and her maternal aunt niece at the time of her death in 1991. Latasha was a student at Welchester High School, and she was buried next to her mother in Paradise Memorial Park. When they talked about Latasha, they talked about her as a school. She wanted to be an attorney, and she got good grades. She was an honor student, and so she was doing well in school. And then I'm going to play a video. I'm just going to let you hear about the incident, because this whole incident was on video tape. And so she had the money to pay for the orange juice, and she was walking away with the money in hand. But again, I'm just going to let this play out, let you listen to what actually happened here.
25 years old, and she probably was bringing her children, even her grandchildren, to the playground that now bears her name. Watch. A playground at the Sutton Rec Center in South L.A. now bears the name of the girl featured in this mural, Latasha Harlins. The 15-year-old was shot to death at a nearby Market liquor store. Today, 30 years ago, at about 9:10 o'clock in the morning, the police knocks at our door and tell us that Harlins had been killed by the store owner. Grainy surveillance video shows a dispute over a bottle of orange juice at the Empire Liquor Store just before the woman behind the counter pulled out a weapon and shot the 15-year-old, killing her. Soon Jadu was found guilty of voluntary manslaughter, but sentenced to time served while awaiting for trial, a $500 fine, and community service.
She did not serve not one day in jail, but was sent home with probation only. This 15-year-old child who got her brains shot and blown out over a dispute over a bottle of orange juice was the precursor to the civil unrest in 92, after the jurors found the LAPD cops not guilty for beating Rodney King.
Activist Najee Ali with the family at the dedication of the playground Harlins used to play at.
Where we grew up at and where we played at oftentimes. So today is a remarkable day. It's like she turned 45 this year. A love song for Latasha was nominated.
A love song for Latasha was nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary Short Subject category. Netflix also sponsored the mural, which is up the street from where she died. A market now sits in the spot of that liquor store, but it can't sell liquor as the zoning was changed to prohibit it in this spot after Harlan's death. We run into a man who went to school with her.
I believe we have come a long way. Sometimes you still have, the cop killings and stuff like that.
He is following jury selection in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer facing murder in the death of George Floyd. Everyone here is.
So I will be going to Minnesota supporting the activists and the leadership there. Hopefully they'll get justice for George Floyd being killed. Certainly, Latasha Harlins never got justice.
But at least today, her family rejoices. Today, 30 years ago, at about 9:10 o'clock in the morning, the police knocks at our door and tell us. So it's just the community. I mean, the love that we receive from the community is
unexplainable. Okay, I kind of talk about that. I wanted to bring that up because in light of, excuse me, we still have these killings going on. And we just recently had a young man, was Jalen, I lost the last
Walker.
Name, but I'm Walker. Okay, thank you. To come to me, where he was shot 60 times, over 60 plus times by the police. And this was in regards to a traffic stop where they, he got out of the car. They indicated that they believed that he had shot at them. And when he got out the car, he got out the passenger side door and he took off and he ran. Long and short of it, several officers were in pursuit. They called him back. He turned around toward them. And as he turned around, one of the officers claimed that they saw him reach towards his pants. And at that point, they began shooting. And they shot 90 plus times, and they hit him like 60 plus times. And I know at least 12 or more rounds were in the face. And so when I think about the injustice that just keeps going on, And they, you know, we had these killings on the 4th of July. You had a white male shoot more than a dozen, just under a dozen people. Well, actually, he shot more than a dozen people, but he killed at least 8 people were killed and wounded dozens of other people. And they brought him in unscathed. You had Buffalo, where this guy profiled killing black people, and they brought him in again after killing 10 people in a grocery store. And he picked that grocery store in Buffalo, New York, because he did recon on the area. He wanted to make sure that there was a good number of black people. He thought about doing it at a school. He thought about doing it at a church. But he picked a grocery store because that, and he had been there multiple times to see what the volume of people were and so forth. So he picked that location, and he shot and he killed those people. And again, he was taken in unscathed by the police. As a matter of fact, he did threaten to hurt himself, but they talked him out of it and took him into custody. And then you have somebody on a traffic stop that you can shoot 60-plus times. I mean, you shot at them 90 times, 90-plus times, and you hit them 60-something times. I mean, who does that? And how do you go home at night and sleep behind that kind of action? You know, and I say that from myself being in law. I can't see doing that to a people. But at the same time, we got this kind of thing going on, and it's nothing new. I bring up this Latasha Harlins, because I think there was a documentary on that from Netflix, but the judge in that case had decided that the shooter, the AIDS Korean lady, was no longer a threat to society and that she made a mistake, and she can tell a good person from a bad person, and she felt that that person was okay, and that, you know, and that's pretty much it. She served no time. You know, she paid a $500 fine, paid for the funeral expenses for the family, but that was pretty much it. And that was but that got kind of smothered a little bit from the Rodney King verdict. So a lot of people didn't talk about this. Latasha Harlins, she wanted to be a lawyer. She was a good student. You know, she just had some difficult issues in regards with family. But she maintained herself in the classroom, and she wanted to be part of helping the community become a lawyer and help people deal with a lot of situations. So that's our ancestral profile. This is just over 30 years from the time that this happened, and so we just give her, you know, all the thanks and man. It's just difficult, just me talking about some of this stuff. It just burns me and stuff with, I mean, because we're dealing with this stuff today, you know, and we're still praying the same kind of way. We got some solutions from a lot of good people that put this information out there and stuff. We just got to start reading these books and coming up with these action plans. And so when I say action plan, and so I'm going to have to talk about my speaker that I have on the line tonight, Reggie Jackson. I'll let him give you information in regards to what he does in regards to nurturing developmental trainers. But he's going to be talking about the racial imbalance of Milwaukee 2022 residential property assessment. And I ran into him at a gathering with some friends, and we started talking, and, you know, you always have these like-minded people that's trying to talk and uplift the community, and everybody kind of shares what they're doing here and there. And I was just overwhelmed, and I'm like, holy cow. Man, I'm glad I'm not getting into it with this guy, because I pride myself on being able to take on people here, there, and this. But this man is just fully equipped, very knowledgeable, and prepared, and just so keen and sharp, and he helps other people so that they can do the good work. And I'd say, so I felt lost a lot of times in the conversation just because, you know, I'm just lacking so much. I'm like, oh my goodness, I need to hear more of this. So I said, look, my listeners would love to hear what you have to say. So Mr. Reggie Jackson, how you doing?
I'm good, brother. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. And, man, I'm glad that you and I had a chance to meet and have some great conversation. And you know, I look forward to further conversations with you outside of just tonight, because I think that you're doing a real positive service to our community. You know, I've always believed this about our community, that we have a lot of positive-minded folks in our community doing a lot of good stuff, but we never hear about it, right? You know, we don't shine a light on the positives in our community. People are focusing on so much of the negatives, and because of that, we don't always get that positive affirmation of who we should see ourselves as. We don't think of ourselves in a positive way. And, you know, as you were talking about the LaTosha Harlins case, I was living out in L.A. at the time. So I lived in L.A. from 1985 to 1993. Lived for a while in Long Beach, and then Inglewood, and then eventually Torrance, California.
Right.
So I want to share with you kind of my memories of the LaTosha Harlins case. And then the lead up to Rodney King, because I think it's important that people don't really understand clearly what happened prior to the civil unrest. I don't call it riots, the civil unrest after Rodney King.
Right.
So when LaTosha Harlins was killed, I remember very clearly. I remember hearing the story on the news, and this is basically what happens. This kid goes into this convenience store, you know, to buy some orange juice. And what she does is she sticks the orange juice in her backpack, which is on her back, and now she's reaching for her money. The woman assumes that she's trying to steal the orange juice because she put it in her backpack, right? So she yells at LaTosha Harlins and says, "You're trying to steal." And the girl's like, "I'm not trying to steal. I'm trying to pull my money out." And so the woman argues with her. She grabs the orange juice. She throws it on the counter, and then she walks out of the store. The woman grabbed this old rusty gun. And it's amazing to me how the judge and other people, you know, talked about this woman who shot the girl and said it was an accident. It's amazing how an accidental gunshot hit this girl point blank in the back of the head and killed her.
Exactly.
Right? Point blank. I mean, point blank in the back of the head, blew her brains out. And we're supposed to believe somehow that this woman is not a threat to the community. Now, she got mad at this kid. What makes you think that she couldn't have got mad at somebody else?
Right.
And so that case was one of multiple incidents that really had people out in the L.A. area really on fire about, you know, racial discrimination. I'm going to give you a couple of examples because I know that most people who didn't live in L.A. don't know about these cases. So right around the same time, this is over a period of a couple years, these things happen, right? There were two Samoan brothers that lived in Compton, California, right? And so one of them, they weren't brothers, but one had married the other guy's sister, right? So the husband and wife got into an argument. She called her brother over, you know, to intervene and protect her. Somebody called the Compton Police Department, right? They came. Now, this is just an argument. Nobody's fighting. It's just an argument. The Compton police come, and by the time they're done, the husband and the woman's brother are both killed. They shot and killed both of them, right? So this is another example of when you call the police to get help, in many cases, you end up with somebody dead on the other end of it, right? So people were very upset about that. Another incident, there was a group of people that had been robbing banks out in the L.A. basin, right, in L.A. and kind of east of L.A. So the police said that there was a gang of people involved in robbing these banks. So one night, like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, this brother was laying in his bed in his apartment. The police thought that he was part of this gang that had been robbing banks. They found out later that he wasn't involved at all. Anyway, they busted in this man's apartment at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, shining flashlights in his face with their guns out, and they tell him, "Show us some ID." Now, come on, brother, think about this. You're breaking into my apartment. You must know who I am. Why do I have to show you ID? So guess what happens? He reaches for his wallet, which is on the counter right next to his bed. As soon as he reaches for the wallet, they unload and they kill his brother people right. were very upset about that. So by the time Rodney King trial ended in the way that it did, when, first of all, they moved it to a community north of L.A., right, which is a community
right.
that was known as a place where retired police officers and firefighters go to live. So
right.
you knew what the outcome would be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the things that led up, you know, Latasha Harlins, these two Samoan brothers getting killed, or these two Samoan men getting killed, this brother being shot in his apartment, were just the tip of the iceberg, because
right.
the L.A. Police Department was so notorious, but not just the L.A. police, but many others, right? And so
yeah.
when
yeah.
all of those things happen with this explosion of rage and people talk about it being riots, like, listen, man, when you think about what happened in 1992, brother, when you go back to Watts in 1965, when you go to Detroit in 1967, when you go to most of these things that people refer to race riots, they were almost
right.
all a result of people responding to police
right.
activity, police beating somebody, police killing somebody. And so I always tell people that you should not call these things riots. These are rebellions. People are
right,
upset
exactly.
at the system. They know they can't attack
mm-hmm.
the system. I'm going to tell
right.
you a story, brother I knew that was out there. This guy was a friend of mine. I used to play basketball with him. He was a student at UCLA. So mm-hmm. when all of the civil unrest happened with Rodney King, he's trying to get back to the campus, right, to get back to his dorm. He goes back to Westwood, California, which is where UCLA is. He gets there, and he sees all of these armed white people in front of the campus.
Right.
And he's like, man, I'm trying to get to my dorm room. He has his ID, everything. They wouldn't let him on the campus.
Right.
This brother could not get back on the campus to his room for safety when all of this crazy stuff was going on, because he had
right.
all of these armed white people who lived in Westwood, California, who would not let him do it. So I always say to people, when you think about what happened in L.A., when you think about what happened in Watts, Newark, New Jersey, Detroit, pick any city, Milwaukee in 1967,
right.
Milwaukee after Seville Smith, the rage that the black community has, that's
right.
the only
right.
outlet they have, right, is white mm-hmm. property. They damage white property because
right.
you know, people,
exactly.
they burn down their own community. It's not their community.
Right.
They don't own
that's
this
right.
stuff.
Right.
So they don't see it as burning their own community. And this
right.
is the point I wanted to make with all of this, is that, listen, when you have a person who is frustrated, I'll always use the same example. Let's just say you go to work, right? You make a mistake at work, and
right.
your boss yells at you about the mistake. You know you want to say something to your boss, but you know, you're jeopardizing your job
right.
if you say something. So what do?
Exactly.
You keep that anger inside, and you take it
mm-hmm.
home with you. You take it home to your community. So now you get home, you're yelling at your wife, you're slapping the kids, you're kicking the dog. That's called displaced aggression. It's a psychological
right.
principle where people
mm-hmm.
hold in their anger until they find
right.
a safer, more convenient target. So when you think about what happened in L.A. in 1992, Milwaukee in 2016, Newark, New Jersey, Detroit in 1967, that's displaced aggression. You're mad at one group of people. You're mad at the system, but you know you can't go out to where white people live and do anything, right?
That's
here,
right. That's right.
There is not a single instance of what people call race riots where black people were involved, where they left their community. They weren't
exactly.
allowed to leave their community.
Exactly.
But you go back in time, brother, and I just mm-hmm. want to share with your audience this,
it
because most people don't know this.
All the time.
In the late 1800s in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was a coup
mm-hmm.
d'etat. Some black men had been elected. Some white men had been elected who were, you know, favorable towards the black community. The white people were upset, and they literally forced these men out of office. They literally had a coup
yeah.
d'etat in Wilmington, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they beat people, they kill people, they burn black property. That's a race riot. They left their community
right.
and went into the black community and did damage. We've all heard of what happened in Tulsa, right? But we haven't heard
yep.
about the anti-black race riot in Atlanta in 1906, which prior to Tulsa was one of the worst ever. We haven't heard about the anti-black race riot in Illinois, in Springfield, Illinois in 1908, which was the spark that led to the creation of the NAACP. We didn't hear about the anti-black race riot in East St. Louis, Illinois in 1917, which was just brutal.
Yeah.
we didn't hear about the 24 or 25 anti-black race riots around the country, from the East Coast to the West Coast, from the North to the South, that occurred in the summer of 1919 because of so much blood being shed. It's known as Red Summer. These race riots,
right,
the one in 1943 in Detroit, where black people were pulled off of the buses and trains in Detroit and beaten by mobs of white people, these are race riots. When people leave their community,
right,
and go into your community and beat,
that's
shoot,
right,
kill, loot,
right,
whatever they
right
want to do, that's a race riot.
Yeah.
When you're doing it in your community and you're using your power to basically do damage to symbols of white America, to this
right
racist nation, that's not race riot to me. That's just rage that is built up over a number of years.
Well, you know, and it's so sad, and I know, and I'm just gonna throw this out there, and I don't want you to answer it now, but I know that we can do another program where we're gonna talk about all the cities that were put underwater of black people, black communities that were thriving and doing well, and how they just, you know, terrorize us in all ways, shapes, and forms. And again, we don't know about a lot of those different things because, you know, these books about these things that have happened, we can't get to them. You know, and this is that critical race theory. You know, as long as you don't know, you're not going to ask questions and so forth. And they're certainly not going to teach it. But another thing that I was going to bring up, there was another incident before we get into our main conversation, but one of the things that I was going to bring up was that before the Rodney King incident, the thing that made Rodney King incident so big was that it was on TV. It was on TV.
Oh, yeah.
And people saw it all over the world. So you got people telling you, you know, that who are you going to believe, your lying eyes or the police? So the thing is, all these other incidents, most of them, they weren't caught on camera. It was just their word against the police, so we know how that goes. Well, prior to that incident, one of the other straws that broke the camel's back was you had some L.A. police officers that were moonlighting doing another job at a movie theater. And there was some black kid at a movie theater, and that's going to be around that same time. So I was going to ask you if that rings a bell, but you know, it happens so often that you know it could just because that's just common. But the point is, this little black kid, about 15 years old, was in the movie theater, and somebody indicated that he was being a little rowdy. So this cop that was moonlighting grabbed him and was holding on to him by the neck, had him in like a headlock, and he just strangled the kid, and the kid died. So after the kid died, you know, of course the officer was in charge, and they said the kid contributed to his own death by fighting with the officer, something to that effect. And so people are complaining. People are angry. They're frustrated. Like you said, where did they release this? And the thing about it is, it's not like they're going to go out to, we're going to run out to these suburbs and go into these white neighborhoods and attack our oppressors. It doesn't happen that way. So, like you said, this place, you know, frustration and anger and stuff where we lash out at, you know, loved ones and other people that are near to, I mean, that's common, you know, and they talk about that so much. So that's pretty, you know, it's just an ugly situation, but this is what we're dealing with. But I was very intrigued with a lot of the conversation that we had when you were talking to me about, you know, the property assessment values and the homes and the disparities and, you know, in this area here, the prices went up maybe 7%, but in the inner city and around a lot of these black people and stuff, the price, it went up to, you know, 13%, even higher. And these people then were booted out of their homes. And then when you said, well, you said Milwaukee is like number two as far as black home ownership, as far as the lease, number
right,
two as
right
far as people not having homes. I mean, it's like second to the worst. You know, and why is that just so common with Milwaukee? And what kind of are we making some bad decisions? What kind of information are we getting? I mean, what is it that you do?
It's a long story.
You nurture, you train people to handle this kind of situation.
Absolutely. Listen, brother, it's a long story. So I want to share this story with people so they get where Milwaukee is today and why Milwaukee, of the 50 largest cities, has the second lowest black home ownership rate. 27% of blacks in Milwaukee own their homes. The only city worse than us is Minneapolis at 25%, right?
Okay.
So people ask, like, well, why is that the case? You know, is it black people making bad decisions? Is it X, Y, and Z, right? And let me share with you how we got to where we are. So nationally, about 42% of blacks own their homes, right? So less than half. Now, that rate of 42% is almost the same as it was in 1968 when the Federal Fair Housing Act was passed, which supposedly was going to end housing discrimination. 41.3% of black people owned their homes in 1968. Today it's 42%. So have we made progress? No, we have not. And these are the things that have happened to make it what it was back at that time. We got to go back looking at Milwaukee specifically. So one of the areas that I've studied extensively is the history of segregation in Milwaukee, how segregation played out, the practices, policies, the people involved. And this is what happened. Milwaukee was a city that was not a place that was a welcoming place for black people for a very long period of time. Now, blacks were in Milwaukee when it first started back in the 1840s. But if you go all the way to 1930, there were only 7,501 black people in the city of Milwaukee. Right? Today, there's over 240,000. So you look at a city, and you've heard the story of the Great Migration out of the South. Blacks fleeing the South, fleeing the Jim Crow, you know, system, fleeing lynchings and all of the other things, the indignities of Jim Crow. Why didn't they come to Milwaukee? I tell people there's a very specific reason they didn't come to Milwaukee, because they knew they were not welcome in Milwaukee. You had realtors who got together in 1924 and literally said, we're going to make sure that we don't allow black people to live in certain parts of the city of Milwaukee. We're going to put these places off limits to black people, right? So in addition to that, Milwaukee was known as a machine shop of the world. You know, we had an economy in Milwaukee that was based on manufacturing jobs, right? A.O. Smith, Harnischbaker, you know, Schlitz Brewing, Miller Brewing, you know, American Can Company, American Motors Corporation, all of these were the really good jobs in Milwaukee, right? But prior to 1941, when World War II started, black people were not welcome in most of those jobs. They couldn't get jobs in those factories. The unions, all of the unions, not just some of them, all of the unions, basically discriminated against blacks, wouldn't let blacks join the union. It was very small numbers of blacks that were able to get those union jobs, right? So what happens is in the early 1900s, people don't know this about Milwaukee. Milwaukee was the most foreign-born city in the United States. It had a higher percentage of foreign-born residents than any other city in the country, including places that we typically think of like Boston, New York, you know, Chicago with like large white ethnic communities, right? It was a situation where the factories were not going to ask black people to come to Milwaukee because they were not going to give them those jobs. They were literally white-only jobs, right? So this is what happens. By 1940, the black population was up to almost 9,000. So not much change, right? But then the war starts, and now you need this labor. And so all of these factories start to actively recruit black people from Mississippi and Arkansas and Georgia and all these other places, right? So the black population from 1940, which is 8,821, grows to over 21,000 by 1950. It continued to grow. By 1960, it's over 62,000 blacks in Milwaukee. By 1970, it's over 105,000 blacks in Milwaukee. And the only reason they came wasn't because Milwaukee is a great city on a great lake. They came because it had good jobs. You know, people picked up the phone and called their uncle and their cousin and, you know, everybody else they knew down south and said, you know, it's good jobs, family-supporting wage jobs. Now, oftentimes, particularly early on when blacks got into those factories, they still faced a lot of discrimination. They couldn't get into, you know, supervisory positions, management, but they fought to change that. They forced these companies to allow them into those positions, right? So this is what happens. At the same time this is going on around the country, the federal government in 1930 wants to provide something to slow down the Great Depression, right? And one of the things that's happening in the early years of the Great Depression is half of all homes in America were in foreclosure. Banks were foreclosing on properties because people lost their jobs. They couldn't pay, right? So what they did is they created a new type of mortgage that had never existed before, and they call it an amortized mortgage. So typically, prior to the Great Depression, you wanted to buy a house. It's called amortized, and I'll explain in a second. But prior to the Great Depression, if you wanted to buy a house, you typically had to pay like 50 or 75% down to buy the house. And they only gave you like 5 years to pay it off. Interest rates were ridiculously high, so most people could not become a homeowner if they wanted to. So the federal government had two reasons to launch this new mortgage. So that they call it an amortized mortgage, which means you're going to pay part of your mortgage will be going towards the principal, and part will go towards the interest. And they're going to extend that loan out from 3 to 5 years, which is typical, out to at least 20 years, and eventually it ended up being 30-year mortgages, right? So what happens is this. They set up a program, and they help all of these banks with all of these foreclosed homes. And they said, we're going to refinance. We're going to help you refinance all of those mortgages so that you can continue to make money as a bank, right? And they're going to lift people out of foreclosure and make home ownership somewhat normal, except this, brother. This is the caveat. They say that we're going to do this only in certain communities. So from 1934 to 1940, the federal government, an organization called the Homeowners Loan Corporation, they draw what they call residential security maps. Now, most people call these redlining maps. They would never call redlining maps when they were being drawn. And what they did is they color-coded maps, green, blue, yellow, and red. And if it was red, then that meant that it was practically impossible to get a loan from a bank, practically impossible to get insurance on a home, right? So what happens is every neighborhood where black people live was redlined. And in Milwaukee in 1938, when they drew the map, there was only one neighborhood black people lived in. North Avenue was the northern border. Juneau was the southern border. 3rd Street was the border to the east, and 12th Street was the border to the west. So every black person in Milwaukee lived in that little box, right? And it was considered what they call, and this is the language that they use, the Negro Slum District. That's what the federal government called it. So when they drew the maps, they also wrote the documents telling you why each area got the ratings that it did, right? So what ends up happening is now, if you're living in one of those green areas along the lakefront, if you're living in one of those blue areas along the lakefront, you're good to go. You're going to get a really good mortgage at a low interest rate. And guess who lives in that part of Milwaukee? Only white people. Right. Yeah. So now they get access to mortgages, right? But all of the black people living in that little box, you're not going to get any. And then the Mexican community, which was very, very small, just a few hundred Mexicans on the near south side, their neighborhood was redlined as well, right? So what ends up happening now, they don't have access to mortgages. There was literally only one bank in the entire city that would give black people a mortgage. And that was a bank that was called Columbia Savings and Loan. It was started by a black family, the Halyard family. They said, listen, black people don't have access to mortgages for, you know, a home or business. We're going to provide them with access to that. So they opened up Columbia Savings and Loan. They were literally the only bank in town that would give black people an opportunity. So now here you have a system that's designed to build a higher percentage of home ownership, but it expressly, intentionally leaves black and brown people out of it. Right. And if that's not bad enough, you also have another system, this is a legal system where white people could draw what would have known as racial restrictive covenants. So if they're building a subdivision in Milwaukee, they're building a subdivision in South Milwaukee, in Sherwood, in Whitefish Bay, pick any community, they can literally write in this document that only white people can occupy this space. Not just that only white people can buy these houses or rent or lease or whatever. Only white people can literally legally occupy these spaces, with the exception of a few of them that said, unless you're a domestic worker and you work for that family, you can occupy that space during your work hours. So what it does is it closes off big portions of Milwaukee and the suburbs where black people, you even regardless of how much money you got, you cannot legally move to those places, right? So these racial restricted covenants started to be used in Milwaukee in 1919 in Wauwatosa, where the first one was drawn, and they spread to 16 of the 18 suburbs of Milwaukee. So they literally made it out of a place for black people to even consider moving to these suburban communities, right? And at the same time, white people are moving out to the suburbs left and right, and they're doing what people who buy homes do. You build equity. So equity, the greatest value of being a homeowner is this. You buy a house and say you got 30 years to pay for it, right? While you're paying that house down, the amount of money you owe goes down, and hopefully the value of your home stays the same or it increases, right? The difference between what your home is valued at and what you owe the bank is called equity. So you can borrow against your equity, right? You can take out a home equity line of credit, a home equity loan, and this is what white people have been doing for decades. This is why they're so much further ahead than us. They take out those home equity lines of credit and those home equity loans. They pay for their kids to go to college, brother. Mm. They pay off any debt that they have. Oh, they lose their job, or we're going to borrow against the equity to get us through some difficult times. They have that advantage. And you know, you're looking at blacks now who barely own any homes. They don't have any equity because most black people were forced to buy homes off of what's called a land contract. And this is the way a land contract works. And they're coming back in the style again. You buy a house from somebody. Let's just say I buy a house from you, right? You sell me the house. Right. Now, I'm paying you every month. I'm paying you the same amount of money every month. And eventually, after X number of years, I'm going to pay off the house, and it's going to be my house, right? But if I miss a payment to you, or if I'm late on the payment to you, I literally violate that contract, which means now you can take all of that money I've given you, and you could keep it and evict me from the house. So this is how black people were forced to buy houses, right? So now you're not building any equity at all. You don't have that same advantage. And now, after all of these decades of this, from the early 1900s, you know, when they put the first racial covenants in, to the federal government creating this new law in 1930. So fast forward to 1950, right? World War II has ended. You know, the black population has grown in Milwaukee. It's grown to about 21,000. We have built a black business district on Walnut Street. You know, people refer to it as Bronzeville. So all of these businesses, half a black-owned business in Milwaukee right on Walnut Street. You know, we had movie theaters. We had car washes. We had dentist offices, doctor's offices. We had all of these businesses. We had the highest black business ownership rate per capita of any city in the country. So black people in 1950 were doing really good in terms of their black business district. So what ends up happening? Everybody will tell you this, brother, and if they tell you this, tell them they don't know what they're talking about. They will say, man, that freeway came and destroyed Bronzeville. It wasn't a freeway, brother. I've shown people, I had to literally show people aerial photographs and show them that when Walnut Street was wiped out, they used an urban renewal program. So urban renewal was a city like Milwaukee could get money from the federal government for what they call slum clearance. So if they designated an area as slum housing, they could tear down every house on that block, and they would get money to build new homes or to just fix up the homes that were there. Milwaukee chose to just wipe out everything. So everything from 6th to 10th Street was bulldozed, every business. Milwaukee used to be known as the Harlem of the Midwest. All the famous jazz musicians and singers came to Milwaukee and performed. A lot of famous people, you know, really loved Milwaukee at that time. And this is what happens. They tear all of that stuff down, and years later, the freeway comes and destroys what's left. So when people tell you that the freeway tore up Bronzeville, no, it was urban renewal projects effectively that destroyed everything on Walnut Street. But this is the other part of it. 1950, I found this very interesting document in the 1950 census, and it showed every active mortgage in Milwaukee County, right? So this is what I found. There were about 28,000 active home mortgages in 1950 in Milwaukee from banks, regular traditional banks, right? There were about 5,000 Federal Housing Administration mortgages that had been issued by the Federal Housing Administration. And then there were an additional 3,000 Veterans Administration mortgages active in Milwaukee County in 1950. So of those 28,000 traditional bank mortgages, only 369 were held by somebody who wasn't white.
Mm.
28,000, only 369 held by somebody who wasn't white. And I can pretty much assure you that all, if not most of those, were probably from Columbia Savings and Loan. The records aren't there to verify, but I'm sure because we knew they were the only one. But then look at the Federal Housing Administration loan. There was 5,000. Not a single one was held by a person of color. Everyone was held by a white person. The VA loans, you know, these loans that were guaranteed and GIs who served in World War II, 3,000 of them, every single one was held by a white GI. Not a single person of color had either of those, right? So that's the situation you're dealing with. You have a thriving business district, but you don't have access to purchase homes,
right?
And so guess what? White people are just they start to build the suburbs. If you look at Milwaukee County, you look at a lot of the communities that exist, they were incorporated in the 1950s. Brookfield was incorporated in 1952, Brown Deer in 1952. They literally start building suburbs for white people to move to.
Mm-hmm.
And these racial covenants in 1948, the Supreme Court said that you can't enforce these anymore. So you can't go in and kick that black family out that somebody sold a house to. But guess what? Nobody pays attention to that law. Nobody enforces it, so you continue to have whiter and whiter and whiter suburbs created intentionally, and black people are stuck in certain parts of Milwaukee. As the black population expands, they move into different parts of the city. And by 1960, black people can finally move north to Capitol Drive for the first time.
Right.
The area around Rufus King High School that was known as Blackfish Bay, that was like an exclusive area where black people lived. But beyond that, you were still stuck in certain places. So this is what happened. 1967, you know, you have the open housing marches in Milwaukee, 200 days of people marching across 6th Street Viaduct. That first day that these marches, about 250 black, mostly blacks, a few whites joined them. You know, everybody talks about Father Groppi, but it wasn't a whole lot of other white people there. These brave black people march across this bridge, and it's mostly kids. This is what's left out of the story. Everybody talks about Vail Phillips and Father Groppi. It was mostly kids from the NAACP Youth Council. They march, and they get to the end of the 6th Street Viaduct. Now, everybody in Milwaukee knows that that part of Milwaukee, the south side, is where white people live. That was a Polish neighborhood on the south side of that bridge, right? So when they got there that first day, they were met by an angry mob of white people that was over 5,000 strong. They were throwing bricks, bottles, bags of feces, bags of urine, yelling every racial epithet you can imagine, telling these people to go back to Africa. And there was a handful of police there. But the police were like, man, we can't control. It's 5,000 of these people. We can't control these people. They said, don't come back. They came back the second day. And now that crowd that was 5,000 angry white people has grown to 8,000 angry white people.
Wow.
Doing the same thing, throwing bottles, bricks, all of this stuff. And so what ends up happening, these brave black people said, you know what, we don't care. We're going to keep on marching. And they marched for 200 consecutive days. Now, you know, the winter in Milwaukee is brutally cold. They marched in the cold. Now, the numbers of marches decreased. But what happens is because of these black folks in Milwaukee standing up to this racism, it becomes part of the national news and the issues in Congress talking about, you know, fair housing. So Congress had been debating since 1966 about some new law that would be related to fair housing, right, making discrimination in housing illegal. They didn't pass it, though. Members of Milwaukee's community went to testify for Congress, and then Dr. King was killed on April 4th, 1968, right, assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. A week later, literally 1 week later, Congress, under pressure, passed the Federal Fair Housing Act in 1968. So at that point in time, 41.3% of black people owned their homes. And we were promised, and I tell people, promises are broken all the time. We were promised that housing discrimination would be over. So now Milwaukee passed a local ordinance against it. The state already had a law against housing discrimination. Now you have you have laws on three levels that make housing discrimination illegal. But guess what? They're never really enforced. So it continues unabated to this day. So you go from 41.3% in 1968 to about 42% today, right? Well, depending on the source, it's either 42 or 43%. Uh-huh. But this is my point.
Right.
While black people were unable to get those loans, they continue to not be able to get those loans. And this is the big shift that took place. When they finally were able to get the loans and buy houses, they were able to buy houses because guess what? They had those good jobs at A.O. Smith and Harnischbaker and all these other places, right?
Yep.
But this is what happens. Those jobs that brought black people to Milwaukee started to go away. They literally started to go away in large measure in an accelerated way in the 1970s, the early 1970s through the early 1980s. So this is what happened. Back in 1963, it was 100 – from 1963 to 2019, Milwaukee lost 108,000 manufacturing jobs. 108,000 good-paying, family-supporting wage jobs that you could work at, retire, get a nice pension, you know, pay for your house, pay for your car, send your kids to college without debt. You could live the American dream, right? But guess what?
Yeah.
Those jobs start to go away, and it impacts the black community more so than anybody else because in 1970, Milwaukee was one of the best places for black people to live. We had the seventh highest median family income for a black family, the equivalent of what would be about $50,000 in today's money. But today, the median family income for blacks isn't $50,000. It's $27,000. That's the median income for a black family in Milwaukee, right? So you have a poverty rate in 1970 for the black community that's 22% lower than the national average for blacks. Black people were doing really, really well, but then the jobs went away. Black people didn't get lazy. Black people didn't decide that they didn't want to do this, that, and they were the victims of the jobs going away. We didn't own Slits or Pabst or Miller Brewing or Harnischbaker or A.O. Smith. White people owned all these businesses. They left the city. And the reason it impacted the black community more than the white community, only about 15% of whites depended on those jobs in Milwaukee in 1970. But 42% of blacks depended on those jobs. And get this, 53% of black men depended on those jobs. So here we have more than half of all black men working in these manufacturing facilities, and now they close up. So you have this huge recession in 1981 through 1982, and all of these black men lose their jobs. So now the unemployment rate is ridiculous in the black community, right, for young men as well as older men. And that was
these jobs, my dad worked at Pabst. My uncles worked there. My other relatives worked. They worked at A.L. Smith. And I remember when they left, and you know, these were the situations and stuff. And then we grew up over there on 16th and Capitol. You know, we were right over there. And so when you talk about everything that you're talking about, I mean, I'm right there. That's where we grew up, and that's where we all were congregated. And when we did leave the neighborhood, and we knew when we crossed North Avenue going south, or even south of Capitol, north of Capitol, you know, it was a problem.
Oh yeah, and so all of those things kind of combine in what I call a perfect storm. You had Milwaukee in 1970 being one of the best places in America for black people to live, and here you look 32 years later, or 52 years later, and now it's one of the worst places for black people to live, right? We have the highest black male incarceration rate of any state in the country. We have the second highest incarceration rate if you include women as well, right? You have a poverty rate for black children that's one of the highest in the country, right? So you have all of these things that have happened, and I'll tell people, like, listen, black people didn't change. The system changed. Milwaukee changed. So this is what happens when a city, pick any city, a big city, a little town in rural Wisconsin, wherever, when the good jobs go away, everything changes for the people in those places, right? You look at any little small little community throughout Wisconsin. You see, go way up in the western, northwestern part of Wisconsin where they have all these logging companies, right, the paper companies. When they go out of business, what happens to that community? They're devastated. People lose jobs.
Right.
Unemployment rate goes through the roof. People become alcoholics. People become drug addicts. You know, the suicide rate increases. Everything bad happens. That's no different than what happened in Milwaukee. The difference is those white people are never blamed for what happened. We are blamed. Like, oh, black people got lazy. Black people don't want to work. Black people busy killing each other. Black people this, black people that. We are never given the benefit of the doubt of showing that it wasn't us that changed. It's the city of Milwaukee that changed. And the disinvestment in Milwaukee, and this is the point I wanted to share in terms of how this is affecting the home ownership for those who are homeowners who now have an increased assessment. So we have this issue of the lowest black home ownership rate in the country, the second lowest. Right. So that means 73% of black people in Milwaukee are renters, right? So what, this is what happens. When you are a renter, your landlord can increase your rent anytime they choose to. You're going to either pay it or you're going to move out, right? That's the only choice you have, right? But people who are homeowners, they don't have to worry about that, man. They get that mortgage, and they can refinance it from 30 years down to 15 years, pay it off. They're done. And they can borrow against that equity for the rest of their lives. So you have wealth building that takes place when you have a high home ownership rate. So nationally, over 72% of white people own their homes nationally and 42% of blacks. That 30, that gap of 30 points is the same as it was in 1968, brother. The same gap. So what does that mean? That means the white people had generation after generation of building wealth, passing on their homes on to their children. How many black people you know that plan, you know, plan their retirement like, you know, when I retire, I'm going to move to Florida, Arizona, wherever, I'm going to give my son or my daughter or whoever the house. That, like, listen, black people acquire homes when their grandmother dies, right?
Right.
Their father dies. That's how black people acquire wealth. Mm-hmm. Nobody leaves us anything like that because they haven't had the opportunity to build up that stuff. So what ends up happening is white people are so much further ahead of us wealth-wise because of home ownership. And it was very intentional that white people became homeowners and black people didn't. So this is the situation in Milwaukee today. We have a situation where back in April, the city assessor's office sent out, you know, letters to everybody that's a homeowner telling them what the increased assessments were on the house. So basically the assessor's office says, well, your house is worth, you know, $85,000, $95,000, whatever, right? You get this letter in the mail and say, okay, my assessment, you know, and they haven't done an assessment in 2 years. They skipped 1 year, right? Well, so the last time they did an assessment was in 2020. So these new assessments cover 2 years' worth of growth in the value of your home. Now, people will say, well, man, if the assessed value of my home went up, that's a good thing. That means now I have more equity I can borrow against, which, if you're a person who's trying to sell your house and your value is going up, if you sell the house, you can make a nice little profit. You can actually get, you know, a decent amount if you sell your house. But what if you're not interested in selling your house? Right? Then what does it do for you? This is what it does for you. It means that your property taxes are probably going to increase significantly here in the fall. So this is what happens. In April, they do the assessments. They send the letters out to people. People have an opportunity to appeal if they think that the assessment is too high or whatever, right? And they're so far behind doing appeals that they're like well over a year behind doing appeals. They still haven't finished appeals that people filed in 2020, right? So they're like way behind. So this is what happens. They released the information, and there were literally two articles in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on their website that talked about, you know, before the assessment letters came out that said, you know, the assessment's going to increase, you know, about 18% citywide. That's significant, right? That's a lot. But this is what they didn't tell you. And I just found out today that every alder person in Milwaukee, 2 weeks before the assessments came out, every single alder person was given the information about what was going to happen with their districts.
Wow.
They were told how much their districts would be increased, right? All of them knew about it. So this is what happened. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a couple of days before the assessment letters come out, they warn people that it's going to be a, you know, significant increase, right? Then the assessment letters come out, and then they write a follow-up article, and they show that the assessment went up different amounts in different parts of the city. So by aldermanic district, you can look at the aldermanic district you live in, and you can find that in the three central city aldermanic district, District 7, which is where I live, District 5, and District Central City, you know, Khalif Rainey's district, Russell Stamper's district, Ashanti Hamilton's district, they had the highest increases in assessed value. Went up in the 7th district where I live, the average went up 32%. 32% increase, right? So everybody knows that if you get a 32% increase in assessment, you're going to see a hefty increase in your property taxes later in the year. But we don't know what that'll be because the city now has to do what they call a tax levy, and then they determine, and by the fall, they'll send those letters out and let you know how much your property taxes increase. But this is what happened. This information came out. It was on the Journal Sentinel's website. Most people don't read the Journal Sentinel, right? They ain't trying to check out the Journal Sentinel because it's very unpopular paper, right? So this is what happens. I read these articles, and then there's a document that they link to. So I click on this document, and it pulls up the data for the whole city, brother. And I'm looking, and I'm like, man, every place where it went up over 20% was either a black or Hispanic aldermanic district. Right?
Wow.
The places that had the lowest along the lakefront, downtown area, and the southwest part of Milwaukee had the lowest increases. So you look at the lakefront, and the assessed values went up about 12%. Downtown, they went up about 10%. The southwest side of Milwaukee, they went up about 12%. But in the central city, they went up over 20% in every district and over 30% in two of those districts. So this is what I did. I said, listen, I know nobody's getting this information. None of the alders are talking about it. So one of the other hats I wear, in addition to being, you know, co-owner and lead trainer for Nurturing Diversity Partners, the business that I've been a part of, that my business partner and I started 4.5 years ago, I write a column for an online magazine called The Milwaukee Independent. So I said, I'm going to take this data and I'm going to create a map showing the increases by aldermanic districts, right? And I intentionally made the map the same colors as a redlining map. So the areas that had the highest increases, I made them red on the map. The areas that had the lowest, I made them green. And when I put that map out there on Facebook, brother, man, you should have seen how many people was pissed off about it. How many people reacted, were angry, like, how come ain't nobody else telling us this? You know, how come the mayor hasn't told us this? The common council members, y'all, aldermen, nobody's telling us this.
Right.
Why I got to see this? Why Reggie Jackson the one that's got to hear this with us?
Right, right.
This is something that our leaders should be telling us, right? So guess what ends up happening? The map I created goes viral. I mean, I don't know how many people have shared it, but well over 100 people shared the map and were like, look, this is what's going on in Milwaukee right now. And so one of the alders called me and was asking me some questions about the map, and I'm, you know, sharing with him everything. And I'm like, listen, man, I'm writing an article, and I'm basically letting everybody know the details of what happened. And I'm letting everybody know that I've been perusing the internet looking for statements from our alders and the mayor about these assessment increases.
Right.
And you know what I found, brother? Nobody said a word except one alderman. Bob Ballman. Now, Bob Ballman, his district is downtown. Now, he came out, he made a very strong statement. He said, this 18% increase is going to hurt a lot of people, particularly poor people, and, you know, this is going to be devastating. I've talked to my constituents, blah, blah, blah. He made a very strong statement against these. He was the only alder that said anything. The mayor's office still hasn't said a word about it, right? So now, Bob Ballman, he's complaining about the 18% increase, you know, citywide, but what he apparently I don't know, maybe he just wasn't paying attention. His district only went up 12%. His was the second lowest increase in the city. So he's speaking for the black and Hispanic community, which saw the highest increases, and their alderpersons are not saying anything for them. So you got this white alderman that's speaking out against this, but none of the other members of the common council, not a single one of them said a word. The mayor's office didn't say a word. So I posted my article about it, and man, it's been like crickets. I talked to a woman today who talked to her alderperson, and this is what her alderperson's person, you know, told her about the article that I wrote. No, that information isn't accurate. Now listen, brother. Anybody that knows Reggie Jackson knows that I ain't no poop butt when it comes to research and have accuracy when I write stuff. When I put stuff out there, I'm telling you where it came from. So this woman who's trying to say that my information is accurate, if I meet her, I'm going to be like, listen, lady, you apparently don't know how to read, because if you read what the assessor's office put out, you would know that that's absolutely where I got the information from. I ain't making nothing up. I don't have to make nothing up. But we have a city where the black community in particular has been disinvested in for the last 50 plus years, right? All of these old raggedy factories that closed down, small and large, across the city of Milwaukee, we allowed the black community in particular just fall apart. So what ends up happening? Back in 2006, all of these subprime lenders come to Milwaukee and they descend on the black community. 62 predatory lenders descended on Milwaukee in 2000, in the early 2000s. 62 different ones, right? Now, this is what they did, brother. Contrary to what people said about what happened with the housing bubble bursting in 2006, 2007, this is what they really did. They didn't just pick on anybody. What they did is they picked on people that had already paid off their houses or were close to paying off their houses. And this is what they said. Okay, brother, listen, man, you only got, you know, a couple years to pay off your house. Or, oh, man, you paid off your mortgage. Man, look at that roof. For you. You can get a new roof, man. You can borrow against your equity and get a new roof.
Right.
Here, take out this second mortgage and pay for that roof. Oh, man, take out this second mortgage. Man, pay off that credit card debt. Pay off that student loans, whatever, right? So a lot of people got those loans, but they didn't realize that they were predatory loans, and they were intentionally designed for people to get screwed. You know, it used to be to get a 15-year mortgage or a 30-year mortgage, there was no such thing as adjustable rate. You knew what the interest rate was from day one. It was going to be the same 30 years later. They came up with the adjustable rate mortgages, right, the balloon payments, like, okay, man, for the first 5 years, you're only going to pay like $67 a month for your mortgage. And then, you know, you have to make this balloon payment. But don't worry about that. By the time you get there, you can just refinance. This is a lie they told people. And what ends up happening is it made the number of people that bought houses across the country just accelerate here in Milwaukee too, right? And eventually it causes the prices of houses to increase dramatically. And when the price of houses being sold increase, what happens? The assessments increase dramatically. And now all of a sudden people are like, wait a minute, this house ain't worth $200,000. This house is worth like $120,000. So now people are what they call upside down on their mortgage. Like, you owe the bank $150,000, but your house is worth like $92,000. So people say, man, it don't make no sense to me to pay this mortgage. People let their houses go, foreclosed like crazy. And this is what ends up happening, brother. A lot of black people lost their homes. A lot of long-term homeowners that had paid off their first mortgage got a second mortgage and got foreclosed on by the bank due to that. Or when the property taxes increased, they lost their houses to tax foreclosures. So you see this acceleration in the black homeownership rate, which peaked in 2005 nationwide. It peaked at almost 50%, and it's gone down every year since then. Right prior to the pandemic, it went up a little bit during the pandemic because, you know, everybody and their grandmother was, you know, offering opportunities because, you know, 2% interest rate. But this is what happened in Milwaukee. A lot of people lost their homes to either a bank foreclosure or a tax foreclosure. Yes, sir.
Brother Red, could you just hold up a second? I kind of went beyond my break time because I usually want to get people in to answer some questions. I mean, ask some questions and stuff, because I tell you, it's just a wealth of information you're putting out there. And I'm like, wow, I am just so overwhelmed. And, man, this is just, I mean, who can you trust? We got these black faces in these places and aldermen and mayor and so forth, and they're not passing on forward this information. And, you know, I'm pretty impressed that you got the response that you got even from Facebook, you know. But I'm going to go to this first caller that's been on the line. 5084. Questions or comments, or are you just listening? 5084. Caller at 5084. Questions or comments, or are you just listening?
Hello.
Hello?
It's 5084. Yeah, this is 5084. How's it going, gentlemen?
Hey, all right. What's up, brother? Is this Brother Ricky, huh?
Yeah, yes, it is. And I am glued to this information. What you're saying, Mr. Jackson, is just completely unbelievable, although I know that it is the truth. And I just want to get your opinion on I mean, what is the end game for the people that created this system, if you can respond to that?
Well, listen, the system of home ownership was created for two reasons in the 1930s. Number one reason was they figured that if they made it easier for people to buy a home, then they could start building homes, which meant they could put people back to work that were out of work during the Great Depression. The other piece of it is they believe very strongly, because there was a strong kind of counterculture in America where communism was becoming popular, socialism, communism, and they wanted to fight back at that. So they figured if we get somebody into a 20-year commitment to pay for this house, they're going to now be a person who embraces capitalism, the capitalist system, right? So those were the two initial, you know, reasons that they created these new mortgages. Now, the other part of it was that they wanted to make sure, because it was intentional, that white people were the beneficiaries of these programs. White people were the beneficiaries of the Federal Housing Administration, you know, refinancing these mortgages. When the VA loans came out, the VA loans were part of the GI Bill, which was passed after World War II. Now, the GI Bill was supposed to work the same for every GI. If you were black, right, Mexican, white, whatever, you're supposed to have the same benefits. So you could go to post-secondary education, college, tech school, whatever you wanted, for free. You could get a loan for a home or a business, right, guaranteed by the VA. So if you default on a loan, the VA is telling the bank, well, listen, we'll pay for it if they default. So what ends up happening, blacks could not take advantage of the VA loans because they were discriminatory in terms of the banks in Mississippi. We're not about to give no black GIs no loan to get a business or a home. You know, they weren't going to do that in Alabama, Texas, Florida, Tennessee, right, Kentucky, South Carolina, North Carolina. So they discriminated tremendously against black GIs. But white GIs, this is what happened. This is a turning point for white folks. 1950, right? 1950, you start to see an acceleration of the American economy into becoming the world's largest, most profitable economy. And part of what happens is these white folks come back and they get to go to college. They get to go to technical school, right? So they become dentists and they become architects and they become lawyers and all these other things. And the black GIs are like, well, what about us? Well, guess what? Mm-hmm. You don't have any colleges you can go to other than the HBCUs. Because 19 states had separate colleges for black and white students. Now, it was only 11 states that broke away and formed the Confederacy. So 8 additional states said, well, we got separate colleges for blacks and whites. Most of the HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, were very small. They didn't have room for all of these people that wanted to go to college.
Right.
They didn't have enough spaces on campus for people to live. So about half of all black GIs who wanted to go to college couldn't go to college in the South because there was no room for them. And they were not about to leave the South and try to move to the schools in the North, wouldn't do it either. So that put black people even further ahead, but it accelerated the wealth for white people, because not only do you have these better jobs, now you can buy a very cheap house out in the suburbs, right? Very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And you can now start investing in the stock market, stocks, bonds, all these other. So now you have this extra money that you can do something with extra money. Black people don't have no extra money. We can't invest in the stock market, right? So it accelerates the difference in wealth between blacks and whites. And here we are all these years later, and we still waiting on some laws that are going to change this. But I tell people all the time, listen, man, laws are only worth their enforcement. If you don't enforce the laws, they mean nothing. So this is what's going to happen in Milwaukee. And I want people to understand this very clearly. 73% of black people in Milwaukee are renters. They did not get the letter in the mail about the assessment increases. Their landlords got it. Now, we know landlords are not about to pick up the phone and call their tenant like, hey, listen, man, I got this letter from the city saying, you know, my property went up, you know, 18%. You know, my property tax is going to increase in the fall. I'm going to have to, you know, make you pay that extra money. They're not going to do that. What's going to happen is they're going to make you pay it, but you're not going to know it's coming because ain't nobody told you other than Reggie Jackson. So this was going to happen in the fall. A bunch of people going to get a call or a letter from their landlord that says, man, I got to increase your rent by $100, $200, $300, whatever it may be, because they are not going to pay that difference themselves. Now, we don't know what the increase in the property taxes will be. That'll be figured out, you know, later this year. But we know, and this is where the trick is, right? So the woman from the assessor's office met with some residents of Sherman Park when the assessments came out, and she wanted to calm them down because they were upset, thinking, you know, oh, man, these property taxes are going to increase for us, blah, blah. This is what this woman told these people. She said, listen, you don't have to worry about it. If your assessment didn't go up 13.23%, that's the number she put out there, 13.33%, 13.23%. If it didn't go up that much, if it was 13.23% or less, your property taxes will stay exactly the same. Now, here this woman is in Sherman Park, and mm-hmm. and the people there clearly know that the area they live in, the assessments went up almost 30% for them. So what she's wow. saying doesn't even apply to these people. I'm like, you should have been on the south side in Bob Bauman's district telling those people, right. or out on the lakefront telling those people that they don't have to worry about property tax increasing because their right. assessments all went up less than the 13.23%. She's trying right. to convince these black folks in Sherman Park, oh, you ain't got nothing to worry about. No, you do. So the property owners are going to see an increase in their property taxes, and then the landlords are going to increase the rent. This fall, you're going to start seeing a lot of people like, man, landlord increased the rent by X amount of dollars. And this is the other part that's playing a role in it. Corporate landlords are buying a property in Milwaukee, like left and right. So now a lot of the landlords don't even live in Milwaukee. The company that owns a lot of the houses in Milwaukee, as of last year, 14% of all rental properties in Milwaukee were owned by companies that don't even exist within the state of Wisconsin. And I'm sure over the last year, it's increased even more than that. I tracked this one company. It's called VB1. Last year, they owned 245 rental properties in Milwaukee, most of them single-family homes, but some of them duplexes. This year, I just looked them up 2 weeks ago. They went from 245 to 688 properties they own now, corporate landlords. And they are known for not only charging higher rents than you know, in-town landlords, but they're also much quicker to evict people when they are behind on their rent. So people are going to be dealing with that situation, and they don't even know it's coming. You know why? Because our elected officials are sitting on their hands, not telling anybody what's about to happen. And it's going to be a lot of folks, man. I said, U-Haul going to make more money this fall than they've ever made before, because there's going to be so many people getting evicted because they like, man, you know, just you're either going to get evicted or you're just going to move, try to find a cheaper place to stay. And nobody is telling people that it's going on. Nobody is warning them. Now, listen, I'm not an alarmist. I just tell people the facts as I see them, right? And these are things that our elected officials should be talking to us about. We vote these people in office. They should be telling people.
Right.
Nobody knows that this stuff is happening, and that 73% of black Milwaukee is renters. When their landlords increase that rent in the fall, in the winter, it's going to be a shock to the system. We already dealing with these ridiculous gas prices, right? We know it's going to be a lot more expensive to heat your houses in the winter, this coming winter. People are going to be in some bad shape, man, I'm telling you. And I don't know what the solution is to this. I wish I did.
Right.
I don't think it's an easy solution, but this is what I want people to know. Like, listen, man, if it's coming, you can brace for it. You can start preparing for it ahead of time.
Right.
You can, like, change your monthly budget. Like, man, you know, we're going to stop eating out. We're going to do this step. You want to eat at home instead.
You can at least
prepare for it. But it's you know, I remember back in the day they used to talk about people, you know, coming up and just hitting you without you expecting. And somebody stole on you, right? Remember that old saying?
Right, they stole on dude. Exactly.
Like, it hurts a lot worse when somebody come up and hits you and you don't expect it versus when you prepared and you brace yourself.
Right, exactly.
This is what's going to happen to the black community. And in the end, this is what's going to happen. The whiter parts of Milwaukee are not going to see an increase in their property taxes. They're not. The lakefront, the downtown area, the southwest side of Milwaukee, which are the three areas that had the lowest increases, their property tax is going to be the same.
And why is it that they target us so much in these situations? You know, what does it profit them, you know, to do that? You know, to move people out, make it so that we can't live in the city or anywhere.
Well, this is
didn't they put out some, you know, when, you know, landlords couldn't put people out and so forth, and they extended and gave them some breaks here and there. But what you were talking about with these landlords being out of the state and so forth, and I mean, they don't have, they're not held to the same standards and so forth, and what protection do we have?
Well, this is how the system is supposed to work. When the CDC put out, you know, this mandate, you know, a moratorium on evicting people,
right?
You know, it wasn't something that everybody abided by. People were still getting evicted, even though it was against the law.
Right.
But listen, you a poor person. Who are you gonna call? You ain't got no money to pay no attorney to fight this eviction, right? So you just we're gonna just move, right? But this is the other thing that people don't know. While this moratorium was taking place, the federal government put money out there for landlords. Now listen, okay, you got this $700 a month, you know, rent you collecting. We know that it's a moratorium. They ain't got to pay the rent. Here, we're going to give you some money to make up for that. So these landlords made millions. Some of them made millions. Now, y'all know who the rock man is, right? This Barada dude.
Yeah, that Barada,
listen, you know how much money this man made from the federal funds for landlords? Millions of dollars. Millions. That he
I know he's got over 3,000 complaints about violations to his properties.
Yeah, ain't nobody doing nothing about the violations. The city ain't really doing nothing. This is the other part of it, though. And when the moratorium was lifted, he went after hundreds and hundreds of people and evicted like a boatload of people. Like one third of all evictions filed in Milwaukee in January, February was from this one person. So he was kicking people out left and right. And nobody really, like, made a big deal about it. Nobody said anything about it. So you have these people like him who is – man, if you see the place where this dude lives out in Brookfield, you'd be like, man, it was like one of them houses out in Hollywood somewhere, right, in L.A., you know,
right.
Beverly Hills. I mean, it's ridiculous how much money this man has. Yeah. And now he's evicting all of these poor people. So why is this stuff happening? I always say this, like, listen, people do not create a system that benefits themselves and then intentionally disable that system. So this is what happened. White people created this system to benefit themselves so they could become homeowners at a higher rate than black people. They could literally legally keep black people out of their neighborhoods, which they felt would keep their property values, you know, steady or increasing, right? So here you are all these years later, you've got a local ordinance, a state law, and a federal law, which is supposed to make all of these things, like, you know, non-existent. But when you look in Milwaukee, we are the most segregated metropolitan area in the country. When you look at what makes Milwaukee different than Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, other places really super high segregation, we have the whitest suburbs of any of the largest cities in the country. This is what people don't get. White people have created like a wall around the central city that makes sure that when they live on that side of the wall, they got all the advantages in the world. They got lower property taxes, right? Their properties, which they bought in, say, 1950, somebody's daddy bought a house in 1950 for $7,000. That's a $300,000 house today. Black people couldn't buy them houses in the suburbs back then. So they have built generation after generation after generation of wealth, and they had that extra money that they can invest in the stock market and all of these other, buy gold and all this other stuff. So they have built so much wealth that black people will never catch up. There's an estimate that
hey,
if
brother,
all things
brother,
were
brother
equal.
Redden.
Yes.
Brother Redden, let me just try with another caller. I got another person on the line. Just hold up a second.
Okay.
Caller at 1569, caller at 1569. Questions or comments, or are you just listening?
No, I'm here, and I'm very happy to information is being provided. It's some things that we suspected, but it's very good that we're hearing it confirmed. But the point was brought up is what do we do about it? Just as everything in history comes in cycles, and we may need to do some of the things that we did in the 1920s where you had multiple families living in one house to reduce what their overall costs are. And it would be a good idea for us to begin to think about what are the ways that we have to consolidate. We can live with more folks living in one space where we're not having to do it in such an emergency that we're prepared for it if we know we don't have these additional funds available to us to make it possible for us to survive this challenging time. And this will come and then it will go. But I think that we may have gotten complacent where we felt we've got our own house, and but we can't afford it. And so that is my suggestion to figuring out ways that we might be able to combat it till we can come up with some other plans.
Yeah, you know, sister, that's a wonderful suggestion. But guess what? We've already been doing that. We've been quietly doing that for the last, since the Great Recession hit 2007, 2008. You've seen a lot of families and friends consolidate and move in. Now you have multi-generational houses, right? So it used to be, you know, the parents, son and daughter moved out. A lot of people, particularly now during COVID, have moved back in to live with their parents, right? A lot of people moved in with their grandparents. You've seen that consolidation so people could afford to places at the end. So we've already done that. But that's not going to solve the problem ultimately, because eventually, listen, you can have your grandson move in, but eventually your grandson is going to have to move out, right? He's going to have to get out of your house. He ain't going to be living in your house when he's 50 years old. When he's 23, you know, getting on his feet. But this is the challenge that I think we have. We have to make people enforce the housing laws in this country so that they can create more affordable housing throughout the city of Milwaukee. Now, one of the things that's going on is you're seeing a lot of new apartments, you know, affordable housing developments, right? So you've seen the developments on North Avenue, you know, the Griot apartment buildings where, you know, Black Holocaust Museum is on the first floor in these apartments, you know, lower-income apartments up above there in the Garfield Elementary School, affordable housing. You've seen this development that's happening over on Center Street on 32nd and Center where they're building, you know, this affordable housing center, which is going to house about 200 families. It's costing $66 million for this, though. My old school, which is 20th Street School, has now been converted into apartments. So you're seeing, you know, affordable housing apartments. But this is the thing that I say, and this is what bothers me more than anything else. When we talk about affordable housing right now and assistance for affordable housing, what we are literally talking about is affordable apartments. We're not talking about affordable houses. Back in the day when they talked about affordable housing in the 1950s, they were talking about houses. So white people had the benefit of getting houses that were affordable. We getting apartments that are affordable. So now guess what happens? You move into that apartment, you paying rent for the rest of your life. You will never not pay rent. Whereas white people, 15 years later, they ain't got no mortgage no more. 30 years later, their mortgage is gone. So now they got all that extra money. They spend it on whatever they want to spend it on. We in Milwaukee are dealing with a situation where we have had a situation where economically, because of the lack of income for black people, and it ain't because black people ain't educated and all this other nonsense you hear. It's a lack of access to the high-quality jobs.
Yeah.
Listen.
Yeah.
Our suburbs are like a whole new space, right? It's a lot of good jobs out in the suburbs and the exurbs. So you go out to Waukesha County. There's plenty of good jobs out there. How are you going to get there? There's no mass transit that'll take you there. There's no train that'll take you out there.
Yes.
Like, you know, you get on the L in Chicago, you can go anywhere, right? So we don't have access to where the job growth is, and this is what happens. Our suburbs, the suburbs of Milwaukee are 75% white. 75% of residents are white. When you look at the exurban counties, when you look at Waukesha County, Ozaukee County, Washington County, all of them are nearly 90% white. So that's where the job growth has been. So if black people had access to higher wage jobs, affordable housing wouldn't be an issue. They'd be able to afford to buy a house or afford increased rent.
And this is where we're stuck at. Like, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place because we can't access those jobs. And as a result of us not accessing those jobs, we don't have the ability to be able to afford to live the way white people are living. So it's a lot of elements. And I say this in terms of solutions. I tell people, like, listen, there are people that are supposed to be accountable for helping us with these things, right? There are organizations whose job is to make sure that there's no discrimination in housing, that if somebody wants to move out to, you know, some place in the suburbs, New Berlin, for instance, because, you know, the schools out there are performing better than the schools in Milwaukee, you're supposed to be able to access that. But guess what? They don't have affordable housing in New Berlin. They built one affordable housing complex. They started talking about building in 2011, and the city of New Berlin fought for 6+ years to not build that affordable housing complex out in New Berlin. The white folks out there was like, no, you know, the affordable housing, you know what's going to happen? They're the wrong people going to move out here and all this other stuff, right? Well, people kept fighting. They forced them to build it. They built it, and if you looked at it, you would never know it's affordable housing. But the rest of the suburbs around Milwaukee have fought tooth and nail to not build affordable housing. So white people had the advantage of having affordable places to live. They still do. And black people, we're losing affordable places to live. We're losing our houses because of the property taxes are increasing. A lot of our elders in our community are on a fixed income, man. You know, they may have a small pension. They got Social Security. They can't afford these increases in property taxes, so there's an anti-displacement fund, but it helps a very small number of people. There are a lot more things that can be done by banks, by real estate companies, by our elected officials. They're just not doing enough to help our community. It's not on us. Listen, when white folks were dealing with all of these problems, you know, foreclosed properties, who came and fixed it for them? They didn't pull themselves up by the bootstraps. The federal government came in and gave them the hookup. After World War II, they built the suburbs for white folks. They took money from central cities like Milwaukee, Chicago, and Detroit, and they diverted it to build the suburbs, to build the freeways to get you to the suburbs, to build the electrical grid in the suburbs, to build a sewage system. They took from the cities and gave to the suburbs, and white people act like they got what they got out there because of what they did. Oh, yeah, you know, we did all the right things. We made good decisions. We did X, Y, and Z. No, you got the hookup. You had access to any college you wanted to go to. We didn't. So when you say, well, you know, my grandfather went and got an education, and that's why he became a doctor. Yeah, you know, it was my brothers that wanted to become doctors too. But where were they going to go to school at? It was only one black medical school, Meharry Medical School, that would even allow black doctors for years. So the situation that we're dealing with is a long-term situation. And I always say this, you don't fix something quickly that took decades to break, especially when it was broken on purpose. Systemic racism is real. And where we are as a community, I think part of it is an understanding of what we're dealing with. The barriers, and holding people accountable, man. We can't just say, you know, we're going to go and vote for this person because they're black and they're going to fix everything. Listen, after you vote, and I say this to people all the time, pay attention to what they do. Don't pay attention to what they say. Pay attention to what they do. Are the things that they're doing investing in the black community, making the black community a better place to live? And listen, we know Milwaukee is considered by many to be the worst place in the country for black people to live. So what a lot of people have done, they've decided to pack up and leave Milwaukee and never come back.
Yes.
You know, they're moving to Texas. They're moving to Arizona. They're moving to Georgia. Mm-hmm. They're moving to North Carolina. I know so many people that have moved, man, over the last 10 years. And all of them that I know that moved, brother, ain't none of them coming back. They like, man, why would I come back to Milwaukee? So Milwaukee is a place that we're going to continue to struggle with, and we're either going to hold some people accountable and have them try to work on fixing these problems, or you're going to end up packing up and leaving, which is the choice that a lot of people have made. I don't believe that the leaders of Milwaukee, whether they're elected leaders, you know, policymakers, I don't think that they've taken our community into consideration when it comes to the money. Listen, all of the money that's being spent downtown, man. Look at all the money being spent building condos in the third ward. Billions of dollars. Billions of dollars. How come none of that money is coming over to our community? That's what people ask me all the time. Like, they're getting all of this money. How come they're not spending it? You know, they spend how many millions of dollars on the hop? The hop. It don't come nowhere near where black people living, right?
Now,
but,
brother,
oh, yeah,
I got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
I got a question for you, brother. You you indicated that you had talked to some different people, and you indicated that Bob Bonneman, Donovan talked to let his constituents know in regards to the hike and the property taxes and so forth, but it wasn't as high as he alluded it to be. But from your district, the older person, did you talk to that person, and did they have a response to you? Did you ask them why they didn't inform you or others in regards to this property tax hike?
Okay. This is what happened. All of the older people knew about the increases happening, right? It's their responsibility as an older person to tell their constituents what's going on. I shouldn't have to call him and ask him. He's supposed to be the one calling a community meeting and letting us know. I shouldn't have to call Khalif Rainey's office like, dude, what's going on with these assessments? Because his job as alderman, just like it is for every other older person, they could do exactly what Bob Bauman did, which is made a public statement and then talked to residents in his district. He was proactive. None of the other older persons in Milwaukee did that. I shouldn't have to.
Right.
You shouldn't have to. We shouldn't have to reach out to them and ask them when they know. And since I put that map on Facebook and it was all of these people that reacted to it, and I've talked to at least a couple people that reached out to their older persons about it, and this is what they've heard. Oh, I don't think that information is accurate.
Mm.
I know at least two people that call their older persons, and that's what they were told. That information isn't accurate. So if I call Khalif Rainey's office and ask, am I going to get the same answer? Maybe. I mean, I don't think that it's the constituent's responsibility when the alder person's job is to community informed. That's their job. That's why they get paid to inform their constituents. We shouldn't have to be reaching out to them, asking them questions. They noticed that they knew 2 weeks before the assessments came out what it was going to look like.
Right.
And why is it there's not a single one of them other than Bob Bauman, whose district is downtown, said a word about it? How is it that the mayor didn't say anything about it? Not a word. Now, when I put that stuff out there on Facebook, I knew a lot of people said, man, I'm going to contact my older person. I'm going to contact the mayor's office. But listen, they're getting crickets when they call, man. They're getting crickets. They still don't want to tell people the truth.
Let me ask you something. I heard you talking about, you know, one of the things that you do, you know, nurturing developmental partners.
Diversity part.
What are they doing? And you're coaching these people so that they can go out in the community and do the work that needs to be done. I mean, what is the work that they're doing?
No, that's something different. So a couple organizations I'm involved with. So one is my company, Nurturing Diversity Partners. So we do diversity, equity, and inclusion training. So we do training about, racism. We do training about, you know, unconscious bias, conscious bias. We do training about, I basically take people through a journey of American history to teach them how America got to be what it is, right? And take the lies that you learned in school and give you accurate information. That's what my company does. We travel around the country doing this training. So we've done training for Milwaukee County. We've done training for Medical College of Wisconsin. We've done training, for the Milwaukee Brewers Organization. We've done training for almost every school district here in Metro Milwaukee. So this is what we do with that company. The other hat I wear is with an organization called the Redress Movement. Now, the Redress Movement was designed to actually work on finding a way to begin to mitigate some of the damage caused. So what Redress Movement is, and you guys can look it up online, it's redressmovement.org. You can go to the website. You can sign up to become informed. What they're trying to do right now, brother, is they're building a coalition, committees of folks who are concerned about these issues related to segregation, and are going to work and push – for changes to happen, positive changes to happen. So that's what that organization is doing. So we're looking at, you know, things like what's going on with the assessments. How do we address that? So we're bringing experts
okay.
in to get advice on that. So those are the things that are happening with the redress movement. So two different organizations kind of with different missions.
Nice. And so, you know, we – with everything that's going on, and, you know, we had our last caller ask, you know, what can we do? And, you know, the comment was made, and I think you gave the answer most definitely, you know, when they basically were like, they're telling us to pull up our boots to straps when they've been given all of these gratuities, favors, and, you know, to boost their own personal wealth. And I mean, that's what we're dealing with, and it's targeted, and it's about the racism. So I'm glad that you're educating people on those different avenues and stuff. I mean, this is a fight, and I'm just wondering, you know, it's frustrating. You know, I mean, what do you do? I mean, you know, it made me think about, you know, my house. I stay here in St. Francis, and you know, I'm beyond it. I'll talk to you about it a little later. When you were just telling me about a lot, I just don't know where I stand right now. And so I do think sometimes of moving or maybe possibly even selling my house just to see if I can get some value out of it and buy something else maybe in the Milwaukee area just so that I can maybe even get a better place, this, that, whatever. But I know that the cost value here and stuff like that, and I don't know. I just we got to sit and talk.
you're in a situation. You're in a situation where you're living in one of the suburban areas of Milwaukee,
right?
Where property values have constantly increased over the last, you know, 60, 70 years. So whatever house you have right now, I can guarantee you somebody bought that house back in the 1950s, probably, right?
Right.
And they probably paid $6,000-$7,000 for it, and it's worth whatever it is today. A similar house built in the city of Milwaukee back at the same time, you know, and I've looked at some of these houses, looking at old, you know, parts of the Milwaukee Journal back in the day, looking at the real estate section, looking at houses that were built in, say, 1958. That were like an $8,000 house, right? And they give you the address of where the house is. So I'm like, okay, let me see how much that house is worth today. So I looked at some in the city. I looked at some in the suburbs. And this is what I found, brother. That $8,000 house that was bought in 1958 in Milwaukee is now worth about $90,000, maybe $100,000.
Mm.
That $8,000 house that was built out in suburbs, in some of these suburban communities, South Milwaukee, you know, where you live, other places, that $8,000 house is now well over $200,000 in value. So same house, built by the same builders, built in a different place, and the value is accrued because guess what? They assess property and they appraise property with a higher value if a white person lives there than if a black person does. Some black people found out during COVID that if they wanted to sell their house, right, they got an offer on their house.
Hello.
Yeah. And what they had to do is they had to unblacken their house. Yeah, they had to unblacken their house. They had to make it. They had to take down all of the pictures of, you know, Stevie Wonder and James Brown and their grandparents and all that other stuff.
Put some pictures
of white folks up in the house.
Yeah.
And then get it reappraised. So the appraiser comes through and they appraise the house at, let's say, I don't know, $150,000. Now let's just say $300,000, right? These are some people in Maryland. The appraiser comes and, yeah, your house is worth about $350,000, right? And they're like, man, no, this house got to be worth more than that. So what they do is they get another appraiser to come in, and they remove every sign that black folks live there. And then that house goes from $350,000 to a $500,000 house. And all they did was took down signs that black people lived in the house. That's all they had to do. So we know there's discrimination, there's racism embedded in the system. And I always say this about racism. If you don't understand that racism is like fighting a lion, if you attack a lion, that lion ain't going to just lay there and let you kill it. That lion going to fight you. That's what racism does. When you try to fight racism, it fights back. And that's
right.
So we're trying to fix a system that is constantly trying to pull us further and further back in time. And that's part of the reason we're not making progress. It's not like we're not trying. We're trying. We're trying real hard. But we got systems in place, banks that aren't owned by black folks. And listen, people think that, well, if we get some black banks, then they'll talk. No. Black banks across the country never have the liquidity, the amount of funds necessary to support their community. And you know why? Because white people are not putting their money in those banks. All the white banks, everybody putting money in the white banks. Black people, Hispanic people, Asian people, Native Americans, they all putting their money in white banks. But you open up a black bank, guess who's going to put money in it? Black people only. And it's just not sustainable. They've been trying that, man, for 100 years. And it hasn't worked.
And
it will never work.
Yeah, and they've got these movements, and it's still going on. And but again, you know, and then you have black people that just don't trust putting their money in the black banks. I mean, that's just the mentality, and that's part of the brainwash.
That's part of it too. Absolutely.
Well, look, we're getting close to the end. We most definitely got to revisit this conversation. I wanted to talk a little bit about I saw something on Amber, what was her name, Ruffin, and she had posted something, and she talked about the secret history of flooding black towns to make lakes. And so I didn't know if you I'm going to send that to you, because I play this stuff, and then I'll look it up and I'll find out there's a lot of truth in it. So I want to make sure, but it's like, wow. I mean, the things that have been done to our communities, and when people keep saying, pull up your bootstraps, this, that, and land that's been taken from us that we own, that's had plenty of wealth, oil, and so forth, and this and that, been stolen from us, like so many things, the inventions that were made. It's like we were the ones. We had to design the blueprints and stuff, but they got the patents for them and so forth. Because so who did I tell you made these things, invented these things? That was us. But again, you know, so with the cotton gin, and we can go on and on with so many different things, because they weren't trying to make life easy for us, and that's what we're dealing with today. And so it's always going to be a big problem. But any closing thoughts?
You know, I think as a closing, I think that people, if they choose, they should reach out to their older person and ask what's going on with the assessments and how that's going to impact, you know, the property taxes if they're homeowners, and how that's going to impact their rents if they're renters. Just ask them, like, you know, what are your thoughts on it? You know, are you going to do anything about it? Because that's, you know, as I said, we shouldn't have to ask them that. They should be reaching out. They should be, you know, they send you 50 million pieces of mail when they're running for office, but they can't, you know, put a little, you know, a little postcard in your box telling you, oh, the assessments went up X, Y, and Z in this area. You know, it's going to affect you, blah, blah. They can do it. They choose not to. I always say this, put pressure where pressure is not being put, and that's how changes happen. We're working hard to change things. We're working hard to figure out how to battle these systems that are in place. But I've said this, and I'll say it time and time again, don't give up. Keep fighting. We wouldn't be here if we weren't fighters. We're the most resilient people this country has ever seen.
Exactly.
We weren't supposed to be here anymore, and here we still are. Take advantage of that resiliency, man. And that's the key.
All right. Well, look, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We're most definitely going to revisit this, and love to have you back on again. It was just a wealth of information. I know that our listeners were being edified, and just, man, I'm not confused. I understand the hatred and the greed, and the lack of concern for the black and brown people all over the world, not just in Milwaukee, but we're just being dumped so much. And I'm just so grateful to have someone like you in your position, giving us that information and getting that information out to us on so many different levels in so many different ways. So I appreciate you so much. And
absolutely.
Tonight for listening to Warriors Way. We will be back next week, Thursday. Again, Warriors Way, continuing to fight And so this is your brother Kwasi saying goodnight. Again, thank our guest, Mr. Reggie Jackson. Thanks again, and you have a good night.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for the opportunity, brother.
Where is she?
Come on back, peaceful.
Whoa, easy now.
I'm gonna be free or die.
I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders, a bullet in my gun. Oh, I got eyes in the back of my head, just in case I have. I can for my people. While the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night, that's when I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me.